Okay, I'm going to slide past 20, almost altogether. It's a repeat type of performance of what Abraham had already done. The idea of his Sarah being his sister seemed to work once, so why not try it again? And actually, in this account, you find out that from the time they left and began to travel, that was the arrangement was there before the first instance. So that Sarah and Abraham had already agreed that were a certain circumstance to come up, this is how they would react. So they just put plan A into action. And you'll notice again that God just steps in and saves the promise. The one through whom the promise is to come is to be Sarah, Abraham's own wife, not a sex. It was going to be Sarah because it was going to be seen to be by the power of God and not by man's working out of God's promise. And we find out that Sarah was preserved and that the chieftain or petty king involved was actually prevented by God from doing anything to Sarah that might be wrong. He sort of boasts to God that he hadn't done anything wrong. And he said, yeah, you want to know why you didn't do anything wrong? I kept you from it. So, better correct the situation there, and he does. Okay, in 21, chapter 21, the Lord takes note of Sarah, and Sarah conceives and bears a son to Abraham. Let's just look at the first few verses so you can catch the tone of joy, because it really sets us up for what's going to come in chapter 22. Then the Lord took note of Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac, that is, he laughs. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old. That's according to the command that was given in chapter 15. As God had commanded. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. You can see that the coming of the promised child brings a whole lot of joy. And when we hit the start of chapter 22, you find that Abraham really has grown to love this boy an awful lot. This was God's answer to prayer. This was a prayer that was made a quarter of a century ago. And it was him that was Abraham's whole hope, you see. It was that seed. It was in his seed that all the nations of the earth were to be blessed. So he really loves the boy. And now Sarah responds in verse 9. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Mocking is a play on the word laugh. It's an intensification of it. It's from the same root that Isaac's name is from. Therefore she said to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son. The son of the maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac. Verse 11, and the matter distressed Abram greatly because of his son. Now that may be a subtle inference to the legal customs at the time that said if the handmaid bore a son, he was not to be cast out. So when Sarah says, cast him out, well, that could involve Abraham in some pretty serious legal disputes among others. And from before, we know that he apparently did love Ishmael. Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. So it troubled Abraham greatly, and it's because of this that God has to step in and make things clear. God said to Abraham, do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be named. The son of the maid I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant. Notice Abraham's response again. So Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, and gave to the boy, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. And then the account tells you how that water didn't go as far as they might have hoped. Things were getting pretty desperate. So Hagar leaves the boy. You're not to picture him as a baby now. Okay, he's 14 or 15 years old. But things are getting desperate, and she leaves the boy at one place and goes about a bow shot the other way, so she doesn't have to watch the boy die. The Lord hearkens to the cry of the boy and shows them a well. And by the way, this is a tradition also deeply rooted in Islam, and they would claim that, no hesitation.
What's that again, please?
Okay, this is important to Islam as well as the Jewish people. Okay, because it's through Ishmael that they claim the inheritance of the land. And it's the tightly dispute that's still over there today. Just as blind as life. Okay, but Ishmael is also promised that he would be a great nation, but he's not the promised line. And that's important. The promised line is going to be the work of God. It's not going to be the work of man. Okay, just having made comment on that, let's move over to chapter 22. It's probably one of the most moving passages in the Old Testament. Here the promised seed has come. Abraham loves him greatly. And what does God tell him to do?
Sacrifice.
To sacrifice him. Now, try that one for stretching your mind. Abraham had walked with God for at least 25 years, and he knew him to be just and upright. That was predicated of his whole intercession for Sodom and Gomorrah. Will not the judge of the whole earth do right? And here he's told to do this. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son. Couldn't rub it in any further. Whom you love, Isaac. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. That is the response again. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day Abraham raised his eyes and he saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship, and we will return.
Does the Bible say we will return? New American Standard says, we will worship and return.
It's both. You just begin to see the way Abraham's mind has been stretched, and he keeps working about, and he can only come through one conclusion. And that's what?
That God raised up Isaac.
Yeah, if he's really going to take him, he must raise him up. The promise had said so. God was faithful to his promise. He stretched his mind in every way, but it's the only thing he can come up with.
What do you suppose as far as the fact that what it did for Abraham that he did have the son when he was 100 and his wife was beyond the point of bearing children? That would be a great faith strengthening for
yes,
him.
Yes, definitely would. I think the whole movement, God's hand was visible at various times. These kings telling Abraham to get out of their land and piling on riches while they did it, really. Go, here, take a few flocks and take a little silver, a little gold, and please get it, go away. Abraham keeps growing richer all the time, and God keeps protecting the promise. And finally, Sarah conceived. 25 years later, so there's been a long time that this has been sitting on his mind. I'm sure he was greatly strengthened by that, by the birth of his son. And that probably made it stretch his mind initially quite a bit more when God said to take the promise and go up and sacrifice it. It's also interesting here to get Isaac's perspective. Verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. You can see the father and the son walking along. Isaac's not a teeny boy. He's up in age, too. Let's see, about 20, 25. Catch a time note later. But here he is walking, and he knows something is missing. Now, he's been with his dad long enough to know that when you go out to sacrifice, you need something to sacrifice. He's got the wood. His dad's got the fire and the knife. And where is the sacrifice? Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." He said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb of the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. You can see a tremendous commitment of faith. Somehow, Abraham's got to see God providing somewhere. And you can just, you just put yourself in his footsteps as he's walking together with his son the whole way. The emotions involved, the commitment, the wondering what God is doing. And they came to the place of which God had told them. Abraham built the altar there, arranged the wood. Notice there's still no provision. So he binds up his son. This is probably the noblest point in the life of his son, by the way. There's no resistance on Isaac's part. He figures his dad's doing the right thing. And laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand, took the knife to slay him. I suppose the question in his mind reaches a peak just about now. There's no turning back. And as the hand is raised, the angel of the Lord says, "Stop. Far enough." The angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, said, "Abraham, Abraham." He said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes, looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Abraham went up and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Their substitution. In the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called Abram a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing, you have not withheld your son, your only son." Now you can hear that echo all the way through, can't you? I'm pretty sure that the only here is Yahid in Hebrew, which is translated Manganes. In Greek, which is the same term used for Christ. God loved the world that he gave his only son. The only is the sense of unique. This was the one provided by the promise of God. There was no one like Isaac. Abraham already had another son, but this son was unique. This was through the promise. "And you have not held your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore. Your seed shall possess the gate of your enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived there. Did you have one there?
No, it just occurred to me.
Which one, the gates of your enemies? Well, if you control the gates, you control the city.
Yes, I do.
That's where the...
I'm just wondering if Israel was the gate, way to all of the era.
I don't think probably that's intended there. I think it's just a general way of saying you have the upper hand. There are some people, when you look at Old Testament studies, that don't see the covenant given to Abraham very important. But notice how many times it's been repeated so far. The Lord keeps bringing it up again and again and again. It's a major theme. And when God appears to each of the patriarchs coming down, he repeats it. So you get the idea that this is no casual covenant with a man. This is a key factor in God's plan of redemption. And just by the number of times it's repeated, we ought not to miss it. God's plan for the salvation of mankind extends to all nations, and in your seed all nations of the earth will be blessed. That's God's plan. But he's going to work it out through a man, through a family, through a nation, until Messiah comes. Okay? But his plan is universal in concept from the very beginning.
When you read through this, it sounds like he's given it again in light of the condition of his obedience. Is there a... it seems like he's... he's given it once. That should be enough. But it seems like what makes it sense, the word seems like it was hinged on his obedience and sacrifice in the sending it.
Doesn't James pick up the same argument? He's arguing that faith without works is dead.
Chapter
2, verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected, and the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. In other words, if it is faith, it'll have works. But the reckoning was done before the works were done. Okay? Well, it's not an aftersight. If the faith is real, the works will follow. If the faith isn't real, it won't bring about that type of work. And this was just the working out of his faith. And you can see that it's this particular point that Abraham's trust, faith in God, are stretched to the farthest point it can go. And his work was the work of faith the whole way. God's going to provide, son. We don't have anything with us. He tells the other lads we're going to return, both of us. He's just got that faith in God, that God is of such a nature that he can trust him, and that the promise is going to come about. Okay, so it's not... James isn't offering the works righteousness. He's offering a faith that is really faith, a trust that is really trust, one that really commits your life in God's hands, which is exactly what Abraham did here. Any questions on this particular section, Roseanne?
I just was wondering about who was speaking to Abraham, because in the first part, in 12, he says, he said, and then it speaks, through, know that you fear God, and that you have not withheld your son from me. And then down when it's the second time he's being spoken to, it says the Lord, and I will bless you and such. Is it in the first time, is it the same way that the angel is speaking for the Lord, or
is the Lord?
Or is it
yeah,
the Lord?
Yeah, you keep getting pushed to the idea that this is no run-of-the-mill angel. This is the messenger. And it was the same thing that we hit during the intercession for Sodom. The three men, two go on, and lo and behold, who's Abraham talking to? The Lord. So very, done very subtly.
In later on with Jacob too, when Jacob wrestles with the angel, isn't that?
The same type of thing happens there.
Yeah.
You wonder where, just at what point, when Jesus talks in John chapter 8, he said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day, was glad. Maybe that's it right there.
So this could be then, or do we know that this is?
We don't know. We sure are left with an overwhelming impression that this is no less than Christ. If man really hasn't seen God at any time, and if it's the Son that makes God known, well, what are you left with? It doesn't seem there's any way to walk out of it, as far as I can tell. So I have to be careful about not making that a rule that wherever the angel of the Lord appears, that it's Christ. Who announces Christ's birth? The New Testament. The angel of the Lord. Okay, so it's, we can't make a universal rule and say this, wherever this occurs, this is Christ. The context has to push it one way. And it's the type of interchange with the Lord and the angel of the Lord that pushes you that way. David?
The text you read out of James is a major text used by Mormons to justify their working out their salvation. The Lord, if you had any words of wisdom, that would help.
Part of the best words are just to look at the account in Genesis. He wasn't sweating and straining to work out his own salvation. He was just trusting that God would somehow provide. All he was doing was just doing what God said and trusting at every point. When he talks to the men, he says, we're both going to come back. When Isaac asks him the question, where's the sacrifice? He's just got to believe that God will provide, not Abraham, but God will provide. If there's to be any sacrifice, it's got to be God's provision, and Abraham knows it. So I think it's the whole character of the count. If the other thing would do is if you did a study in the New Testament on the relationship between obedience, works, and faith. Do that. Right in Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about he is sent to bring about the obedience of faith. The Greek can well be taken the obedience, which is faith. Just like, let me give you an example of that in English, the city of Chicago. Of Chicago defines what city you're talking about. Well, the Greek is like that too. The sign of circumcision is that circumcision is the sign. So you find that of relationship sometimes. It's just bringing over the genitive in the Greek, which says this is what this is. And it occurs far more often in Greek than it does in English, although we picked it up somewhat because we tried to render the Greek, quote, literally, end quote, by saying of something. So where you see five of stacked together, that's one possibility. One of them is a defining situation. Does that help you at all? Okay, chapter 23 accounts the death of Sarah and Abraham's purchase of a burial site in the Promised Land. And other than that, I don't intend to say much about it. Chapter 24.
May I ask a question here?
Sure.
Was that a fair price? Or was that an exorbitant price?
It's really hard for us to tell. It wasn't a cheap price. Now, the rest of the conversation is a polite formality. We'll give it to you.
Again, that was just like talking about before. You really expect to be paid for it.
That's right. But notice that Abraham was one you stood up and took note of. He was a very wealthy man, a very powerful man. But it would have gone against the ethical code at the time if he had said, okay, I'll take it.
Well, this one time, Abraham really owned the land. He was still a soldier.
That's right.
even though the Lord had given him.
That's right. Remember, he said that I'm giving the land to you, but he also said that there's his seed would go into bondage, hard bondage, and after 400 years or four generations, they would come out and possess the land. Now, that hadn't come to pass yet. But by faith, Abraham is staking a pretty important stake. That's the burial site. That's an important piece of property right in the promised land.
The fact that Abraham was such a rich man, yet he was so dependent on the Lord and stuff, really speaks to me, because just in reading through Proverbs and what I pick up in the New Testament, a person that becomes rich, not needing to trust the Lord with material things or other worldly goods, it's very easy to slip into non-commitment or just ignoring the Lord. And so he must have just a tremendous humility about him, just in realizing everything did come from the Lord.
You see that same type of thing in Job, who was a rich man before calamity after calamity hit. He was a rich man after God restored him. But there was, you know, here are the exceptions that prove the rule. So you see in Proverbs right around 30, the proverb of Abraham said, Lord, give me enough so that I'm not tempted to steal, but not too much so that I trust in my riches. Okay, chapter 24 has really been precious to me. Those of you who aren't married yet, here it comes.
Oh boy, oh boy.
Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had a charge of all that he owned, very responsible man, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I live. You shall go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant says to him, the servant's taking care of any unforeseen possibilities. Suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land where you came? Abraham said to him, beware lest you take my son back there. God has given a promise, and I'm not going back on the promise. The land is here. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house, from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me, and who swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you and will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there. God has brought Abraham a long way. He's not willing to retreat, back up his path of faith. This is where God has brought him, and so be it. Now it's up to God to provide somebody for his son. He's making sure that it's not of the perverted Canaanite group.
I still don't understand. Where is Abraham at this time?
Abraham's way down here around Beersheba, okay? And the servant's going to come all the way back up in this area.
Out of Canaan.
Yep, he's going to go out of Canaan back to the family. Okay? That's a long journey.
And what was the servant asking then? Is he saying, suppose the Jacob?
Yeah, suppose I get up there and the woman says, I'm not going to go till I see the man. Oh, what do I bring? I go back and fetch him and bring him all the way up? Abraham's comment. No, the son is not to go back up there. God had brought Abraham down here. Now we've got to get the wife down here. And his confidence is that the messenger of God, the angel of the Lord, will go before the servant. He's got that trust in God. Okay, that's enough for the servant. He's got his directions.
His aspect of desiring not a wife among Canaanites, where does that come? Is that Where is that coming from?
I think Abraham is I don't know whether it's by his relation to Hagar that he realized that when you end up taking a woman out of the promised land, you end up in problems. It could be. That has really been a heartbreaker for him. And you'll see the same type of thing cropping up in the life of Jacob and Esau, where Esau reaches out and takes Canaanites at about the age of 40, and it says they really vexed Isaac and Rebekah. So there's more here than what we have as far as information. There's that background that knows that this is the type of wife you ought to pick.
What is this, put your hand under my thigh? What is that?
It's just a means of, how would we say it?
Shake hands, make a deal.
Shake hands.
Cross your heart and hope to die.
For kids. For kids, that would be about that same type of thing. Or sign it in blood. Or really show me that you understand this is no minor thing. This is a serious oath. And you're staking your whole honor on it. And he understood that. Okay, so the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. And the servant took 10 camels. Now, that's not a small number of camels. That's a pretty good size. And this is just a token of Abraham's wealth. That's all. You know, it doesn't list all his stuff, but you get the idea here that if he just sending 10 camels up just to make the trip there and back, that he's got a little substance. And sent out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand, and he rose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. And Nahor would be right around Haran. And those cities have been identified in archaeology. So they're really there. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well. That was a pretty quick journey, wasn't it? It took about part of a verse. Outside the city, by the well of water at evening tide, the time when the women go out to draw water, and he said, "O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today. Show loving kindness." That's that word, loving kindness. It's the word chesed, a very important word in Hebrew. You find that an awful lot of times in the covenant relationship. If you're going to show chesed to God, you respond to his loving kindness in like manner. Okay? The other thing you can do if you don't show that is to be treacherous. But if you're going to be faithful and respond in a reciprocal action in a covenant, then you show loving kindness. Show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. How may it be that the girl to whom I say, "Please let down your jar so that I may drink," and who answers, "Drink, and I will water your camels also." Now there wasn't just one camel. There was 10 of them. So it wasn't a sweet chore. May she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to my master. And it came about before he had finished speaking. This is part of the neatness of it. Before he got through praying, behold, Rebekah, who is born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin. No man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me drink a little water from your jar." And she said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels." You see his eyes bug open now? Until they had finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar in the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. The servant still hadn't come to the full conclusion that this was positively the girl. Now, he needed to know one more thing. What was that?
Whose jar she wants.
Was it from the right family?
Yeah.
was the relationship right? Now, everything has been go so far, so he waits for one more thing. Is the Lord really doing a miracle in front of his eyeballs or not? It came about when Hamel had finished drinking that the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel, two bracelets for a wrist weighing 10 shekels, and gold. He said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" And she said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Ding, ding. All the lights were now go. Okay? And you notice that he proceeds right along. He's not going to let this promise slip through his fingers. He goes to the house, explains everything, and the people there recognize immediately that this is not somebody making up a false tale, but this indeed is the work of the Lord.
Who's Nahor?
Nahor is the brother of Abraham. We had Terah, Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Three brothers. Okay?
Question here. The fact that the city was the city of Nahor, does that mean Nahor is pretty... Is that named after him?
It's hard to tell or whether that was a common name. Because they went to Haran, but Haran, the other brother, had died back in Ur. So it may be that this is just one of the common names. We don't know. And it may be that this particular fellow had gained prominence. He at least had enough, the family at least had enough hay in that where they weren't worried about feeding 10 camels and going broke.
Question. Now, this was the right line because what? One, let's see, she was of the same line as Abraham?
Okay, she was from the same line, the Semite line.
Uh-huh.
Okay, which had some godly tradition. Not all. We found out, we will find out when we hit Joshua, I think about 24, that Terah was probably one who worshipped a foreign god, probably the moon god, since it was both prominent in Ur and up at Haran.
I see. And that was the deal that Abraham wanted, was that the wife come out of the Shemite line.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
I'm trying to figure out the relationship between Bethuel, Milcah, and Nahor. Right? Somehow.
It doesn't give the whole line here.
No, but it sounds...
Nahor has some descendants, okay? And you get Bethuel. I don't know how many change. You'll have to just figure it out yourself.
Is
it okay.
A man or a woman?
Here's the woman. Okay? And she has... 8 children, something like that, described in the previous chapter.
And this Rebecca is the daughter of Bethuel and
Rebecca. Right.
So well, there couldn't be that many
between
if Nahor and Abraham were brothers. There
no,
couldn't be that many generations.
You wouldn't think there'd be that many. That's right. But there are probably a couple. Remember, Abraham bears awfully late in life.
Yeah. Well, Abraham is... Wait a minute.
Great-granddaughter of Nahor.
Isaac and Rebekah were related as...
And Isaac doesn't get his wife till he is how old? 40 years old.
So it's probably like her great-uncle or something.
So there's a... Yeah. There's a... quite a few years that have passed by the boards here.
Got one generation too much.
Okay, when he sees all the lights lined up, he's seen the prayer start to be answered before he didn't even finish praying. The lady's coming. She fulfills his prayer request right down to the nitty-gritty, including 10 camels. Watered a whole bunch of them. Okay? And he finds out that she's of the right family because he had promised Abraham that he would be faithful in that matter. Then he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brother. Then the girl ran and told her mother's house about these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. We'll see him again. Laban ran outside to the man at the spring, and it came about that when he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, and when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, saying, "This is what the man said to me," he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring, and he said, "Come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels?" So the man enters the house. And let's see here. Anyway, as you look at the discussion that follows, they're not questioning what the Lord has done. They realize it. This is the work of the Lord. What else can we do? Can the girl stay over 10 days and she can go? Well, the servant's not too happy about any delay. So he says, I need to get going now. I've got to be headed back. Well, let's bring in the girl and see what she says. Are you going to go? Yep, I'll go.
What don't you think?
Yeah. And she goes. And you notice that when you get all the way up to the end of the other journey, and they journey all the way back, and you find out that since then, all of Abraham's estate has been entrusted to Isaac, and that's sort of mentioned here. So she knew she wasn't getting a bad financial deal. The one she was to marry had plenty to take care of her. He comes all the way down here, and Isaac is somewhere in the negative here. And he has no question about her either. She's the one. Moreover, Sarah had just died, and she was a real big comfort coming after that loss. Now, when I read that going to the Naval Academy, I said, look what the Lord is able to do. There was no girl in sight for Isaac, none of the local yokels were the right ones. And God brought this girl out of nowhere, seemingly, hundreds of miles away, to be the one. I said, well, Lord, if you could do that then, how about now? And it really gave me faith. I said, well, Lord, here I am. I'm a senior, Naval Academy. I don't know any girls. June week's coming up. What are you going to do? I think you can do it. So I trusted him. About 2 weeks later, I was eating dinner with some friends at the restaurant. I was a big eater at that time. And I was feeding my face, second, third helping or whatever, sinful as it was. And this lieutenant said, "Doug, who are you taking to June week?" I said, "I don't know, the Lord will provide." He said, "Yep, I've got a girl in mind." And I took her to June week. Well, even before I took her to June week, at that time there came up another possibility. So I said, "Lord, what do I do?" And this particular girl is a girl by the name of Carolyn Taylor, who is the daughter of Clyde Taylor. Any of you heard of him? The president of an evangelical group that is very, very well known. And they had been missionaries over to India for 10 years. I said, "Okay, Lord, what do I do now?" I sat down to write a letter to ask this other girl. And I couldn't write. I never had that problem before. I said, "Okay, Lord, I'll invite this girl that you have brought into my life. She's my wife." And it's really great. Now, it as far as following a pattern on down, no. You know, it isn't the pattern that I had a servant, because I didn't. I couldn't send anybody 1,000 miles away with 10 camels.
Not even with one camel.
Not even with one camel.
How about a nice little car?
So I had no convoy or anything. But the idea is that here's Almighty God working in history, and it's important for his promise line to be husband and wife in in the context of a covenant. Okay, and it was important to God. And if you read the rest of the scripture elsewhere, you find out that it's extremely important to God that his people marry Christians in the covenant. And he gets very hot under the collar when they don't. As a matter of fact, we find out later in Numbers that when the people intermarried with daughters of a foreign god, that the people began to apostatize. And the leaders of the people end up having to slay these people who didn't care about God's covenant to avert the wrath of God on the people, so that there could be a nation that would come down so that Messiah could be born. We talked about what happened in Genesis 6 when the